Okay, in Job 12 tonight, Job 12, and remember that in this first round of speeches, Job's friends, their speeches will get briefer, shorter. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, each of them get shorter along the way, and Job's speeches get longer. Here in Job 12 through 14, I believe this is the longest one speech he will make until we get to chapters 29 through 31. But we divided the chapter up in three parts. And first of all, we put verses 1 through 6. Job is a laughingstock to his friends. And this is the New American Standard Bible. Then Job responded, "Truly then, you are the people, and with you, wisdom will die. But I have intelligence as you. I'm not inferior to you. And who does not know such things as these? I am a joke to my friends, the one who called on God, and he answered him. The just and blameless man is a joke. He who is at ease holds calamity in contempt, as prepared for those who whose feet slip. The tent of destroyers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure, whom God brings into their power." So Job responds. Now, this is the first speech in which Job has started by insulting the friends. They have insulted him in the last couple, Bildad and Zophar have, but really this is the first time that Job answers them in kind. And truly you are the people, and you can hear this dripping with sarcasm if you're listening closely, and maybe if you're not listening so closely. "Truly, you are the people, and wisdom will die with you." You've got all the answers, but he says, "I have intelligence as well as you. I'm not inferior to you." He will state the same thing in chapter 13, verse 2. "What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you." And in verse 3, he says, "Who does not know such things as these?" It is very difficult in Proverbs or in Job to sometimes answer, what does such things refer to? Who doesn't know such things as you say? Well, what is he referring to? What is he saying that they all agree on? What is he saying that they disagree on? It's difficult to figure out. But the essence of some points of disagreement in verse 4, he said, "I am a joke to my friends." Now, a lot of versions have the word laughingstock here. Laughingstock. "I am a laughingstock to my friends." Now, that particular word, laughingstock, is used twice in verse 4. Here are a few of the other passages where this word was used. It was used in Jeremiah 20, verse 7, of Jeremiah preaching there. Jeremiah 20, verse 7, Lamentations 1, verse 7. It's used in Psalm 31, verses 11 and 12, Psalm 35, and verse 15, and Psalm 69, verses 10 through 12. Now, usually when this word laughingstock is used, it is the wicked who are making the righteous a laughingstock. Usually that is the case. Now, there is an exception to this in Psalm 52, Psalm 52, in verses 5 through 7. There is a case where the righteous make the wicked a laughingstock, because the wicked experiences calamity and he had not put his trust in God. It is used that way, but that's not normally the way it's used. It's normally used for the wicked people making a laughingstock of the righteous. Now, I'm glad to see a lot of you writing those verses down. We have not had that opportunity as much in the last few weeks. And some of those verses are going to come back into play with us later. But not only is he a laughingstock, but he is a laughingstock to his friends. To his friends. To those who should have been the closest to him. Those who came in chapter 2, verses 11 through 13 to mourn with him. They have been a disappointment to him. They have been, his friends have been like a dry wadi. And when he looks aside needing water there, they have not been there. That was in chapter 6 in verse 14. And I'm tying those two passages, Job 2:11, Job 6:14, together by the use of the word friends. And look at the one that they are now making a laughingstock. One who called on God and he answered. Now, some versions, I think it's the NIV here, that makes this a future tense or a present tense. If you have the NIV, is that correct?
What verse are you talking about?
We're talking about verse 4. How's it read?
I have become a laughingstock to my friends, though I called on God and he answered.
Okay, okay. That's not exactly what I was thinking. So it must not have been the NIV. But I do think this is past tense. That he's saying, I called and God answered. Now, those same two words, called and answered, were used in Job 9:16. There, he called on God and he would be, if he answered, Job would be flabbergasted. Job would be absolutely stunned. But he is a man in the past who has called upon God, and God had answered. The Psalm 99 uses that term, and it mentions men like Moses, Aaron, and Samuel as ones who called to God and God answered. And he said that's the category that he fits in. That he may have lived before them, but he's fitting himself in that category. I am one who called on God and God answered. I am just and blameless. I am righteous and blameless. Now, that's a pretty high estimation Job makes of himself, isn't it? But remember, this word blameless is the same word God used of him in 1:1, in 1:8, and 2:3. Someone else who's called righteous and blameless in the Bible. Noah. Genesis 6:9. One of the reasons that may be significant, remember Ezekiel 14:14 mentions Noah, Daniel, and Job, mentions them together. And the same kind of terms that are used to describe Job in Job 12:4 were used to describe Noah in Genesis 6 in verse 9. And so he is mocked. He's a laughingstock. He is a source of ridicule, even though he has called upon God and God has answered, even though he's just, even though he's blameless. And he says in verse 5, he who is at ease holds calamity in contempt as prepared for those whose feet slip.
Now, here the New King James Version has the reading as a torch, which fits the definition of one of the words, but it doesn't seem to fit at all in the translation. What do we do with that? And so the New American Standard, he who is at ease holds calamity in contempt. Often to be at ease is a sense of negligence and a sense of affluence and indifference. And what Job is saying is the one who has a careless ease, a careless indifference because things are going well with him, when he sees others who experience calamity, he likes to think he brought that on himself. And that way, he kind of makes a barrier between himself and trouble. And by the way, we all do that, don't we? And sometimes legitimately. I can remember visiting with a person outside of Washington, D.C. a few years ago, staying the night with him. And one of the first stories he tells us is that just a few months before, someone right outside his door had been shot and murdered. And it's one of the first things you want to hear when you're staying with someone for the night. And he said, I never lost a minute of sleep over it. Because he was shot because he was involved in drugs. And he says, I never felt threatened at all by that. So we do that sometimes, don't we? Does that mean everybody who gets shot outside their door automatically uses drugs? No. David, you had a thought.
Yeah, I've got a footnote for that phrase. It says, literally, contempt for calamity is the thought of him who is at ease.
Okay.
It's
contempt for calamity. Yeah, I think it's the same idea in that passage. It's worded in a different order, but it gets a lot of the same words.
That's the literal order.
Yeah, okay. And so I do think we end out at the same place with that. And in verse 6, he says, the tent of destroyers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure, whom God brings in their power. The tent of destroyers prosper. I think that statement is one of the main grounds of disagreement between Job and his friends. Is it true that the tent of destroyers prosper? Job said, for example, in chapter 10, verse 3, that God looks favorably on the schemes of the wicked. He looks favorably on the schemes of the wicked. Is that true? It may seem like that, simply looking from outward appearances. The tents of the destroyers prosper, those who provoke God are secure. And this particular word, secure, was used in 11 verse 18, where Zophar said that if he would trust God, Job would trust God, that things around him would be secure. And Job's response is, the tent of destroyers prosper. Those who provoke God are secure, whom God brings into their power. Now, it's at the end of verse 6 that a lot of your translations are really going to differ. Some of them have God as the object, like the New American Standard, whom God brings into their power. The idea is,
These people are prospering, and God has power over them. God has them in his hand, and yet they're prospering, so somehow God is making them prosper. Other translations have the word God as an object, like they carry their God in their hand. Like they carry their God, they worship their God, or that their God is their power. Now, whichever way it is a description of the prosperity of the wicked and God's involvement in the picture of the prosperity of the wicked. But what thoughts, do you have any thoughts, any questions right there? Main idea, in spite of some difficulties, Job is trying to do right, he's a laughingstock, while the tents of evildoers prosper. That's the main thing that Job and his friends are in disagreement about. And let's look at verses 7 through 12. But now ask the beast, and let them teach you, and let the birds of the heavens, and the birds of the heavens, and let them tell you, or speak to the earth, and let it teach you, and let the fish of the sea declare to you, who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? Does not the ear test words as the palate tastes its food? Wisdom is with the aged men, with long life is understanding. So ask the beast, ask the birds. Now, is it true that wisdom literature often appeals to the things that God has made, to the world that God has made, the creatures God has made, in order to teach lessons? You know, all of it is God's world, and we can learn lessons from all of it. For example, I think that most everyone, if not everyone, is going to know the answer to what I'm about to ask. When the book of Proverbs is encouraging hard work, industry, he tells the lazy person, go to the ant. Go to the ant, oh sluggard. Proverbs 6, verses 6 to 11. And the ant serves as a rebuke to all those who are lazy. So when your children are slow in getting out of bed in the morning, go to the ant, you sluggard. But now ask the beast, let them teach you, and the birds of the heavens, and let them teach you. Maybe this is a rejoinder to Bildad before, who acted like the former generations could teach Job. And Job says, hey, I'll tell you, you could even learn from the beast and the birds. But now, this is a question. What is he learning from the beast and the birds? What is it they teach? That's not real clear in context. It could be this, and I'm not saying this with certainty, but this would fit the context. This would tie the previous section to this. In the animal kingdom, politeness, gentleness, and meekness always wins the day. Is that right? Oh, not quite. Not quite, Mr. Lion. It doesn't always win. His point could be, you learn from nature what you're saying doesn't apply anywhere. It doesn't apply to people. It doesn't apply in the world God created. It doesn't apply in any of these circumstances. That could be what he is communicating, but it's difficult exactly to know. But whatever it is they're teaching, it isn't anything profound. And it could be, too, Job's response to that statement in 11:12,
where an idiot will become intelligent when the foal of a wild donkey is born a man? It could be this statement is response to this. Now, here in verse 9, there is something unique. You should be able to notice it in your translation because the word Lord will be there in all capitals. And this is the only time in this dialogue, any of this section between 3 through 37, that the name of the Lord, Yahweh, is used. It's used frequently in Job 1 and 2. It's used frequently in Job 38 through the end of the book. But this is the only time from chapters 3 through 37 that it is used. A similar phrase is used in Isaiah 41 and verse 20. Some think that the scribes, remembering that wording, copied the word Lord here. We don't know. We just don't know why it would be so unique in this place. If indeed this word belongs, this may show us that though they may have referred to God normally by other names, they were not unaware of the name Yahweh. But verse 10 does teach a truth that all of Scripture teaches. In whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? Acts chapter 15, the Lord himself gives life and breath to all things. And in him we live and move and have our being. Remember when Daniel rebuked Belshazzar in Daniel 5 for drinking from the vessels of gold? He said, you have drank from the vessels of the God who holds your life breath in your hand. Daniel 5 and verse 23. And so in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? In verse 11, does not the ear test words as the palate tastes its food? Just like we taste our food, we make a determination of how appealing and appetizing it is. So we are listening, testing arguments, weighing them. Does that make sense? Does that not make sense? And that expression will be used by Elihu in 34 verse 3. 34 verse 3. But then in verse 12, wisdom is with the aged, and with long life is understanding. Does that sound like something Job has said? Or does that sound more like something his friends have said?
It's more like Job.
Okay, you think so? It could be argued that chapter 8, verses 8 through 10, that it sounds more like Bildad. But it could be that Job is using an expression they're using. I'm not saying with certainty that I know that he's just quoting the friends. But it could be he is taking their words and say, hey, listen, the aged people really agree with me, not with you. He could be taking their own type of phrases and saying they agree with me. But some people believe he is simply quoting the friends in verse 12. He's quoting them, and that while he says that wisdom is with the aged in verse 12, in verse 13, he's going to give the response to this, that ultimately wisdom and understanding, two of the things mentioned both in verse 12 and 13, that they belong to the Lord. Yes.
I've got a question. Earlier, you contrasted Job 12:10 with Acts 15. What verse was that?
That was Acts, a couple of verses, Acts 15. No, it was Acts 17:25 and Acts 17:28. At least a couple of those that I made reference to.
Okay, thanks.
In chapter 15 and verse 10, Eliphaz says, both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, older than your father.
Yeah.
And so he does...
He does make the same kind of argument, yes.
Yeah, a few chapters.
Yeah, they have used it before, and they will use it again. Like you say, in 15:10, it's a good point. Any other ideas on that? Micah?
You mentioned the name Yahweh in 12:9. Mm-hmm. It was my understanding that name was really introduced to Moses in the beginning of Exodus. Is that...
I think that can come, that is an interpretation of Exodus 6, 2 and 3, which I don't think means that name was not known before then. I think what it means is the full meaning of that name will be revealed by what I'm about to do in Exodus. One of the reasons I say that, Micah, is because there's another passage in Jeremiah 16:21 where God says he's going to reveal the full meaning of that name in bringing the people out from Babylonian captivity. No question about whether it's been revealed before at that time. It is a question about whether he's just going to bring out the significance of it in a new, meaningful, and powerful way. I think that's what the passage in Exodus 6 means. Exodus 6, 2 and 3. And one of the reasons is because you see the Lord God from the beginning of the Bible. And it is used in the patriarchal narratives. What the passage in Exodus 6 says is God wasn't known by that name. Some take that as absolute, and I am taking it more as a statement that it is saying that the full meaning of that name is going to be shown by what he's going to do.
Okay. Now, verses 13 through 25 give what we sometimes call a doxology. We sing a doxology, praise Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. A doxology is a statement of praise. I want to just read this, and I want you to think. What is, big picture-wise, without just focusing on any one part, overall, how would you sum up this doxology? Here's verses 13 through 15. With him are wisdom and might. To him belong counsel and understanding. Behold, he tears down and it cannot be rebuilt. He imprisons a man and there can be no release. Behold, he restrains the waters and they dry up. He sends them out, and they inundate the earth. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The misled and misleader belong to him. He makes counselors walk barefoot. He makes fools of judges. He loosens the bonds of kings. He binds their loins with a girdle. He makes priests walk barefoot and overthrows the secure one. He deprives the trusted one of speech and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on nobles. He loosens the belt of the strong. He reveals mysteries from the darkness and brings the deep darkness into light.
He makes the nations great and destroys them. He enlarges the nations and then leads them away. He deprives of intelligence the chiefs of the earth's people and makes them wander in pathless ways. They grope in darkness with no light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man.
Now, let me just ask you to sum that up, big picture wise. What would you say the emphasis is on God's activity in that particular passage? Did you grasp that? Because I think that you will grasp it if you don't easily when we say it. But David, what would you say?
He's all powerful. He's in charge.
Okay.
Nothing happens that
okay.
He doesn't.
Okay. He's all powerful. He's in charge. He's in control of everything. Agree with all of that. All of that is there. All of that is there. Looking for something a step beyond that.
Seems like the emphasis, he tears down not to be rebuilt. He's imprisoning, not release. He's restraining.
Would you say the emphasis is on God's constructive or destructive power? All of these things are true that David stated, but particularly they're true in the fact that God tears down. You know, like in the Jeremiah, let me illustrate this, okay? Let's look at verse 14. Isn't it beautiful to have this board? I hate to erase all these, but since some of them we're going to reinvoke, but he tears down and it cannot be rebuilt. He tears down, cannot be rebuilt. Now, Jeremiah is going to continually use four words. Jeremiah 1 verse 10. See, I have appointed you this day over the nations and over the kingdoms to pluck up, to break down, to destroy, to overthrow, to build, and to plant. Okay? That's really six terms. But those terms, a couple of terms he used, God says, I'm going to use you to tear down or destroy. Now, one of those two terms is our same term that's used here in Job 12, verse 14. But God also says he's going to build. And the term build is the same as the term rebuild. Now, but this is my point. In Jeremiah 1:10,24:6, 31:28, 42:10, and 45:4, maybe some more, but at least in those five passages, the same God who tears down is going to rebuild. But what does this passage say? In this passage, the emphasis is on the one who tears down, not rebuild. It's never rebuilt. It's kind of like the Tower of Babel. Once that project is called off, it is never re-engaged in. And that is what the emphasis is on what God does. God is using his power, his might, which cannot be questioned, which cannot be called into account. He is using it particularly for destructive purposes. Okay? Now, generally, when you see language where God is tearing down, And God is, where God's tearing, well, just take the book of Jeremiah, for example. When God tears down, why is God tearing down? Why is God tearing down in the book of Jeremiah? Just for the fun of it? Or why? The people's sin. God tears down because of sin, because of the people's sin and iniquity. I want to ask you something. You can look back through it. How many references here are there to the sin of the people?
Ask that again.
How many references are there in this passage to sin being the reason that God tears down and it will not be rebuilt? How many times is that said? None. None is that said. Now, there's nothing in this context to limit this to Israel or Judah or God's people. After all, we saw that Job himself may not have been an Israelite. Probably wasn't. He's not limiting it to that nation or that people. And in this particular passage, there's no reference to sin being the reason. Where Job is in life, he sees what he's focusing on about God is how God brings down and destroy, and we can't do anything against him. So everything he says is true. And yet there is an emphasis, even what we might think of as a dark emphasis in this passage. Now, look at the terms in verse 13. Wisdom, might, counsel, and understanding. That's the terms the New American Standard used. Wisdom, might, counsel, and understanding. Two of them were used in verse 13, identical words. It may be a contrast to verse 12. Verse 12 is wisdom is with the aged, and with long life is understanding. But Job says, with him are wisdom, and to him belong understanding. The very qualities that they attribute to the aged, Job attributes to God, but God uses them. God tears down and it cannot be rebuilt. He imprisons and there can be no release. It's one thing to have your door open and no one can shut, but to have your door shut and no one can open, both of those come from the language of Revelation 3 and verse 7. God imprisons and there can be no release. Now, look at what God does with the waters. Eliphaz in Job 5 and verse 10 praised God. He praised God that God gives rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. It is a remarkable, beautiful thing when God sends rain. But in Job's case, either God withholds it or God sends too much of it at once. In verse 15, he restrains the waters and they dry up. There's a drought that sweeps the land. Or he sends the waters and they are inundated with it. They are devastated. They are overthrown. This is the same word for God overthrowing Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. In verse 21, in verse 25. In verse 19, with him are strength and sound wisdom. The misled and the misleader belong to him. Isn't it interesting? He doesn't say,
the sincere and the misled, or the noble and the misled. But the misled and the misleader. He's focusing on the more negative qualities of humanity. Do you notice in verses 17 through 21 that Job is going to mention pillars of society? He mentions pillars of society. Counselors, judges, kings, priests, trusted ones, elders, nobles, the strong. And what do we know them for? We know them as people who are wise, people who can speak the right words, people who lead and direct a society. Often a group of people are largely dependent upon them. But here, what does God do to them? God makes them fools. He takes away their trusted words, takes away their discernment of speech. God makes fools of the wisest. In Job's pain, that's where Job focuses. Who often walks barefoot? You see that in verse 17. Who often walks barefoot in the Bible? Okay, people when they're being led off to captivity. You see that in Micah 1 verse 8. This word barefoot is used for people who are carried into captivity. Another word for barefoot is used in 2 Samuel 15 verse 30. When David flees from Absalom, it is noted that he is walking barefoot all the way. That's why it's such a big deal when the father says to the prodigal, put sandals on his feet. Because to be barefoot was a lowly thing. He makes counselors walk barefoot. He makes fools of judges. He loosens the bonds of kings. Now, most believe the idea is he's taking off the royal garments of the kings and he's covering them instead with a loincloth, the clothing of shame, in verse 18. He makes priests walk barefoot. He overthrows secure ones. He deprives the trusted ones of their speech. He takes away the discernment of elders. He pours contempt on nobles. He loosens the belt of the strong. In verse 22, he reveals mysteries from the darkness and brings deep darkness into light. The word mysteries is the same word translated depths in 11 verse 8. In 11 verse 8, and there the Bible talks about, or maybe it's 11:7, but it's the depths of God. The depths of God that are mentioned, I think it's 11:8. That's what I had in my notes. I know that's the English word, but I'm trying to think that might be the Hebrew word in 11:8. But in 11:7 or 8, whichever one, it is the depths of God that Zophar mentions, and it's the same word used for the mysteries of darkness. God reveals to us the depths of darkness. Do we really want to know pictures of the most depraved things that go on in our world? I don't. Now, some probably would.
He reveals mysteries. He reveals the depths and the darkness and brings deep darkness into light. That word deep darkness, that's the word used for the valley of the shadow of death in Psalm 23 and verse 4. And God brings those things in the darkness out into the light. The only positive note you really can get in verse 23 is the fact that God is said to make nations great, but then he quickly destroys them and he enlarges nations and misleads them. He takes away the intelligence of the chiefs of the earth's people. He makes them wander in a pathless waste. In Genesis 1 in verse 2, the Bible says the earth was without form and void. But the word translated formless is the same word used here. It is a pathless waste, Job 12 verse 24. And people are groping in the darkness like there's no light. They are staggering like drunken men. That is not a beautiful picture, is it? But to Job, in the midst of his pain, in the midst of his suffering, it seems like God is trying to stand in the way of every success. The statement made in Job 5 verse 12 by Eliphaz. Eliphaz says that God frustrates the plotting of the shrewd. Job would just say he frustrates the plotting of man. Now, we're going to try to tie this together in just a second. But right now, do you have a question about that section? Karen?
So in 14 and 15, the ESV says, if he tears down, none can rebuild. If he shuts a man in, none can open. Is that, like, I agree that this is a very pessimistic, destructive type, what he's saying, but is mm-hmm. it, does that fit the text that it's possible he could be saying that if he were to do that, no one could.
Yes.
No uh-huh. one can turn it around. Like whatever he does, no one's going to be able to resist it. Type of thing.
The word "if" is not in the Hebrew text. Okay. Now, I do not remember. I'll need to go look up and see if there was an equivalent to that in the Greek translation. But there wasn't. There's not in the Hebrew. Okay. He just says, "Behold, he tears down." It cannot be rebuilt. So that's what he focuses on about God. Now, come back and revisit some of this, okay? But right now, I want us to see about how Jesus fulfills Job 12. How does Jesus fulfill Job 12? Well, one, he says, I am a laughingstock. A laughingstock, a joke, a mockery. And I said that a couple of places, and I gave you some places that Hebrew word was used. I hope you got them all down. I hope you're not expecting to go home without those verses in your possession tonight. And a couple of those verses were Psalm 31, verses 11 and 12, and Psalm 69, verses 10 through 12. One thing that's significant about both of those psalms, as those innocent people are being a laughingstock, those psalms are both
quoted to refer to Jesus' experiences on the cross. Father, into your hand I commit my spirit. Psalm 31 verse 5 is quoted in Luke chapter 23, Luke 23 verse 46. Father, into your hand I commit my spirit. In Psalm 69, in verses 20 and 21, when Jesus says, I thirst, he may be referring to these verses where they give him vinegar for his drink. This is my point. Job experienced being a laughing stock even to his friends, being mocked by them. They ridiculed his faith. Jesus experiences this on a deeper level. Now, most of the ones mocking him were not his friends. They simply deserted him. They left him. They left him alone. But others did engage in mocking him and ridiculing him. So whatever Job experiences, if Job thinks that his experiences are unfair and not right, that God lets him experience these things, Jesus experiences this on a whole different level. And they assume that Job is guilty. They assume that Jesus is guilty. In Isaiah 53, in verse 4, he says, we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. While the friends think Job is getting what he deserves. Well, the friends are thinking that in Job 10 and 12, verse 5. That's what people thought around the cross as well. And is it fair that God makes the counselors walk barefooted, that he loosens the bonds of kings, that he removes their royal garments and puts on the clothing of shame and makes priests walk barefooted in the crucifixion? The King of Kings, the priest after the order of Melchizedek, has his royal robes removed, and he is walking in the clothing of shame, if with clothing at all. The text doesn't specifically say that Jesus walks barefooted to the cross. I don't have any doubts that was the case. But the text doesn't specifically make a point of that. What I'm saying is that in a real way, the thing that Job describes in verses 17 through 21, where kings, priests, and counselors while these are shamed and humiliated, this happens in the cross. It happens in the cross, where God becomes a person And he is shamed and humiliated and rejected and murdered. Truly, in the cross, darkness was brought out into the light as men commit their most depraved act and crucify God come in the flesh. But what's interesting about that is the same act in which the King of all kings, the one who upholds all of society and all of justice and honor, this one was humiliated and shamed. At the same time, he shames and humiliates the rulers of this world. This is really what Paul is constantly talking about in 1 Corinthians 1, about verse 18 through the end of chapter 3. But there's really, really a heavy accent on this from 1:18 to 2 and verse 5. And where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this age? 1 Corinthians 1, verse 20. And it says, we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, to the Gentiles foolishness, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, the foolishness of God, because the foolishness of God, and that's what they're thinking the cross is. The foolishness of God is wiser than men. The weakness of God is stronger than men. Paul said, we preach wisdom. But in 1 Corinthians 2 verse 8, it's a wisdom which none of the rulers of this age have understood. For if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. The point is that while he experiences all the shame, the humiliation of the kings and the priests and the counselors and the great men, in that very act, in bringing salvation through it, in that very act, he is bringing down the wisdom of this world. He's showing the foolishness and emptiness of it. And it kind of reverses some of these words here. For example, we talked about tearing down and not being rebuilt. Do you know the word used for rebuilding in the Greek translation is the same word used in a passage where he says, destroy this temple, and I will build it again in 3 days. Now, that's not the same word, the same Greek word. But in the next passage, they said, it's taken 46 years to build this temple. And are you going to rebuild it? That's where it's used. In 3 days. But the point is, he's going to rebuild. And they're not going to be able to tear down. He's going to be raised. And they're not going to be able to stop it, nor to reverse it. So, what Job now is in his pain focusing on is God's destructive power. But by God becoming a man and suffering as Job did, and beyond that, he is going to bring the power of salvation and resurrection and, in a sense, breathe it in to this passage. What thoughts do you all have there? Yes, Gavin.
Verse 15, when it says he restrains the waters, it reminds me of when Jesus calms the storm.
Okay, yes, good point. And there are probably a lot of individual things like that, yes, he does. That's a very good point.
Well, thank you guys. Enjoyed it. What we'll try to do, Lord willing, next Tuesday, if we can, we'll try to go over Job 13. Probably take a break for a couple of weeks, and start again anew at the first of the year and look into Job 14. So we're glad that you're here, and we're glad that you studied with us. And Gary, would you want to lead us in prayer as we close?
Yes.